Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blessed for Life, everybody. My name is Jawanza. This is actually Jawanza for Life. We've got several shows, so we are very excited today to be able to bring you another show. And we just want to know that everybody's all right. I hope you had a fabulous week. And we're actually waiting for our guest right now. We're actually waiting for our guest right now. And this is going to be a very, very interesting show. If we're able to bring our guest up, we're going to be talking about comedic spirituality today. Our special guest is Orowa Hehimetura Nkomet. He is the paramount king of the Osiriset Society. And, wow, I mean, this is going to be just one of those shows. It's going to be informational. We're going to be talking about spirituality. You know, a lot of times everybody's always searching for God. Everybody's searching for that higher power. Everybody, I mean, you've got so many different religions out here. You've got Islam. You've got Christianity. Okay, you know what we're going to do while we're waiting for our guest? We're going to just go ahead and play a little music and see if we can't get our guest on, and then we'll be talking about spirituality, okay? Now, our guest appears that he's here, and we're going to bring him on board. Brother Orowa, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Awesome. My special guest, as I was mentioning to everybody, is Brother Orowa. He's the paramount king of the Osiriset Society. His name is actually Orowa Hehimetura Nkomet. He's the paramount king of the Osiriset Society. I would like to say greetings to everybody who's here. Greetings to everybody who has, you know, tuned in. And again, as I was mentioning, Brother Orowa, before you came on, everybody's searching for truth. Everybody is, you know, searching for that higher power. You know, we've got so many different religions out here. I mean, you've got people who are Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Hebrews, Black Hebrews, White Hebrews. I mean, the Assyrian religion, Rastafarian. I mean, everybody is searching for that way to find answers to the problems that life presents, and we are oftentimes calling on a higher source, a higher power, to get information, to get answers to the questions, to get healing, to, you know, we have our petitions before God. And as I was mentioning before you came on, that this show is going to be about comedic spirituality. And what a better person, I can't think of a better person to talk about it than the paramount king of the Osiriset Society. Welcome to Jawanza for Life.
Thank you for having me.
That's it. Brother Orowa, I just want to jump right into it. You know, so many times people, again, as I mentioned, you know, are searching for answers. And with comedic spirituality, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of Kemet. You know, when people talk about comedic spirituality, you know, there's a lot of different systems out there. But what actually is comedic spirituality? Who are the comedians?
Okay. Well, the Kemet was a civilization that was built along the Nile Valley, from extending from above Nubia up to the Mediterranean Sea. So the people of Kemet were African people who were cousins to the Nubians. You know, they traced their ancestry back down into the central southern part of Africa, and today the area that we would say around the so-called Lake Victoria, that's where they traced their ancestry. And they migrated up the Nile, and as they moved along, then they constructed this civilization.
Okay. So now, why is their spirituality important? What can we learn from the ancient Kemetians and their spirituality, and how can we apply those principles today?
Well, it's important because it's the oldest historical spiritual record. As a matter of fact, it's the not only is it the oldest existing historical spiritual record, but it's also a record that has been the source of a lot of other spiritual teachings. The oldest records were recorded in those structures that we call pyramid texts. So the scriptures that were written there, we're talking around 2300 B.C. or so, B.C.E. And that's the first place that we find where man is recording the understanding that there is a supreme being, and that the supreme being is the source of all life in the world.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, there's a book called the Book of Knowing the Manifestations of Ra and of Overthrowing of Pep, wherein it gives the creation story. And again, this predates anything, predates Akhenaten by more than 1,000 years, or more than 1,000 years before there could have been a Moses. And in this scripture, it talks about how the supreme being, speaking in the first person, referred to itself as Nebuchadnezzar, says, I am the one who came into being, and eventually I brought myself into being as the creator. And from that, then I became God the one, then God the three, etc. And so it goes through a process of explaining how the supreme being brought itself into being as a creator, and then established the world based on law. And there are 11 laws, what we refer to as the Pout and the Teru, which were given as the foundation upon which creation took place. So this passage is very important because, one, it says that there was one single reality, one monotheistic reality. But secondly, that this reality, the supreme being, itself relies and built the world based on law, which to communicate to us that law should also be the foundation upon which we lead our lives.
Okay. So now these laws, well, let me go here. Let me ask this question, because I think this can help to lay the framework or the foundation for the topic of comedic spirituality. The question then becomes, well, what was the purpose of creation? Okay, what was the purpose then of establishing these laws? Because from what I'm understanding then, that if we are to be the vehicles of God in the world, you know, then God is actually experiencing itself through us. So if you could expound on that, you know, as far as what is the purpose of the establishment of these laws, so that we can kind of get a background or a basis from which to, you know, go into the discourse about comedic spirituality and why comedians believe what comedians believe, or what is the Osirian religion?
Okay. Well, the basic foundation is that God is a divine being. That's kind of redundant in saying such. And that prior to manifestation or creation, God had no vehicles through which to experience its divinity. And, you know, to summarize its divinity, we'll say that we'll use the omnis that people refer to, omnipresence, omnipotence, and omniscience. So we'll say that prior to manifestation and creation, God is a divine being which has three primary qualities: omnipresence, which means the ability to be everywhere, omniscience, which means to be all-knowing, and omnipotence, which means to be a manifestation of expression of all potentiality.
Okay.
But prior to creation taking place, there is no place for God to be. If you think of to be omnipresent, that means that there has to be a place, there has to be a whole lot of places, an infinite number of places, and then I have to dwell in those places to be omnipresent.
Right.
But before anything is created, there is no place, meaning all creation is the process of bringing into reality, bringing into existence places, things, houses, cars, people, animals, minerals, all these are places. So prior to manifestation of anything, energy is in a what we call an infinite expression, or it's undefined. So creation is a process of defining energy. And through the definition of energy, places are constructed. And once places are constructed, then God, this divine being, has the ability to experience its omnipresence. So the same can be said for the omniscience and the omnipotence, meaning knowledge, to know something, there must be something there to be known. We know things.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So I can't be all-knowing. I can't say I'm all-knowing if I haven't experienced all things. But then prior to manifestation and creation, there are no things to be known. So God manifests a world of things, hence to know these things, hence to realize his omniscience.
Uh-huh.
So all of the things that are manifest now is an infinite number of things, so they're all different in their energy organization. Because all things are manifestations of energy, and what we refer to as spirit. So when we talk, when our ancestors refer to spirit, they're talking about the same reality that is today referred to as energy and matter.
Okay.
So we say there's two aspects to our being. God has two aspects. One is his consciousness, which we say is immaterial, meaning it can't be divided, it can't be parceled off, it can't be separated or segregated. And the other aspect is spirit, which is energy matter, which can be divided, can be parceled off, can be separated and segregated. So these two aspects make up the totality of what we refer to as the divine being. So then the process of creating the world is a process of bringing into reality, organizing energy matter into an infinite number of constructs so that the consciousness, which is indivisible and immaterial, can dwell within these limited beings all at one time and experience its infinite potentiality.
I'm with you. So now, it appears then, though, to the eye, or to the unknowing eye, that these different manifestations are actually different, okay? But its core or source is the one divine power or divine being, God, as we call it, that has manifested in all these different shapes, forms, things, correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
So now the question becomes, well, if we got all these different things that are created or manifested, how does God experience itself amongst this plethora of creation? What is it that enables God to function in the world as it is a divine being?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to understand this, we have to look at, well, the different strata of creation, the different vehicles that are created. We have the mineral kingdom, which is composed of, you know, molecular structures that have a mineral basis. We look at, you know, take the periodic table, and we have all these different elements, which are a part of the physical world that constitutes the mineral kingdom. Then we have the plant kingdom. Now, the plant kingdom comes out of the mineral kingdom, or it doesn't really come out of the mineral kingdom. It is interdependent with the mineral kingdom, in that plants rely on minerals in order to survive, in order to develop, in order to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the human kingdom. Now, the human kingdom is also a constituent of and a part of the plant and the mineral kingdom. So within the human kingdom, there's also these plant functions and these mineral functions and elements.
Okay.
But what separates, well, also I left out the animal kingdom, which is, again, a part of the same structural, creative piece of potentiality. But what separates these different creations, these different aspects of creation? How is it that God can dwell in all these things at the same time and realize its divinity at the same time? Because what we know about God is that God is infinite in his potential. And we know that the mineral kingdom is a finite reality. We know that the plant kingdom is a finite reality. We know that the animal kingdom is also a finite reality, as is human, that these are finite creations, meaning there are limitations that each of these have. So how is it, and what gives God the opportunity then to dwell in the world as an infinite being if the vehicles that is created have these limited constituents?
Very good question. Good question.
And so the answer is in the 11 laws. Yes, there's a world that's created that has these different kingdoms, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And these kingdoms are organized based on these 11 laws. And these 11 laws operate through these seven parts of the spirit, seven divisions of the spirit. So when God created the world, he created the world in a hierarchical arrangement. So there's seven different parts to the spirit. This is energy matter that's been differentiated into seven different vehicles. These seven vehicles have 11 functional capacities. These are the 11 laws. And through this creation, this infinite being, this divine being, is able to somehow experience itself. So let's look at it from the perspective of these 11 laws and these parts of the spirit, because this is what gives us the answer to the riddle of how, through this finite creation, this infinite being is able to experience its infinite potentiality.
Okay.
So we said there are seven different parts of the spirit. So let's start at the bottom and work our way up, because the bottom parts are the parts that are most easily recognizable and understandable to everyone. So the lowest part of the spirit, the bottom part of the spirit, is what we call the physical world. So everything that you know that is physical, I mean, it's made up of molecules, it's made up of atoms. These atoms are constructed into molecules, which are constructed into compounds. All the things that we can touch, taste, smell, feel, and hear, all of this is what we call the seventh part of the spirit.
Okay.
That's what we call the phenomenal part of the spirit, or the physical part of the spirit. The sixth division of the spirit is made up of what we call subatomic energy or radiant energy. It's the part of the spirit wherein electromagnetic energy is experienced or expressed, like X-rays, gamma rays, quarks, all of these things which are subatomic. They're below the atomic level. They're operating on the energy level, but they're part of the physical world. This is the sixth division of the spirit. We call it the animal part of the spirit because the animal, what we call animal, comes from the Latin root anima, which means to give movement to something.
Okay.
So an animation, like to animate a cartoon, is to give movement to these still pictures.
Okay, okay.
So everything that is a part of the physical world has an animating principle, an animal principle. That's why rocks, even though they appear to be just sitting there actually go through movements. They contract and expand. We learned in elementary science that when you heat up a metal or a mineral, it causes it to expand, which is movement. When you cool it down, it causes it to contract, which is movement. So the animating principle is a part of all physical reality. So 6 and 7 both dwell on the physical level, or the phenomenal level, we call it. So we have this animating energy which gives movement to the physical body. So these, what we call a physical body, has an animating body around it. This is what, for an ease of conversation, when we study acupuncture, for example, right, and the acupuncture, everyone's familiar with acupuncture, so it's a good example in terms of how the animating body part of the spirit operates. The acupuncturist sticks needles into the body, the physical body.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't stick these needles into physical channels of energy. It sticks them into what we call electromagnetic channels of energy.
Okay.
So in other words, when an acupuncturist, if you have a problem with your lung, for example, and the acupuncturist says, well, you're having problems with your lung because you're not getting enough energy to the lung and your lung system. So I'm going to stick a needle in your body to release the blockage to allow the lung energy to flow better. Now, he's not going to stick the needle in your physical lung. He may stick the needle into a part of your ear or
mm-hmm.
into a part of your hand or onto your leg or torso or another part
mm-hmm.
of the body. So, and there's no direct physical connection between that part of the ear and your lung. So he's not sticking it into a nerve, for example, or he's not sticking
right.
it into a blood vessel, for example, which may connect between the ear and the lung. He's sticking it into an electromagnetic channel of energy, this animating energy, this sixth division of the spirit that we're talking about, which flows throughout the body and connects these different organs at different ports along the physical body. So even though he may stick it into the ear, he's sticking it into what we call the lung meridian. So he may
okay.
stick a needle into another part of the ear, which was sticking to the stomach meridian. He may
mm-hmm.
stick a needle into another part of the ear, which may stick into the heart meridian. So again, we're talking about these needles being stuck into these channels of electromagnetic energy, which animate or give movement to or energize the physical structure that they correspond to.
Okay.
So that's the 6 and 7 parts of the spirit. Now, the next 5 divisions of the spirit operate in what we call the mental realm or the metaphysical realm, meaning metaphysical just means beyond the physical. So we have the physical world, and then we have the metaphysical world. Which that's the area of reality which is beyond the physical. That's the area of reality where our mind operates. That's the area of reality where our thoughts originate and operate. So
okay.
to know that our ancestors knew very clearly that there's a physical part of being, but there's also another part of being which they called the first, second, third, fourth, and fifth division of the spirit, which scientists have come in and created a different term, which they call mind. But the Greek word, which was used to extract to become what we call the mental realm, psyche, in Greece also meant spirit. So it was just a way of these new spiritualists taking the language, taking the changing the paradigm so they could control the discussion about what was spirit. Because up until that point, it was the preacher man, the priest, who had
mm-hmm.
control of the dialogue. So once they created something called the mind, that took the dialogue away from the spirit people's talk. And create a new discipline called the psychic people talk.
Okay.
We now have psychologists, psychiatrists. We have a whole, quote unquote, science that's created around discussing the mind or the mental part of being, which is what our ancestors referred to as spirit. So different terms talking about the same reality. But whereas they only come up, I mean, Freud came up with these three parts of the psyche, right? The id, the ego, and what's the other one? Somebody will call
The
it.
The id, the ego, and it escapes me right now. It's on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah. It's no problem. And they're still trying to figure out what these things are. Our ancestors broke them down into five different parts. And they were very clear and strategic and specific and scientific about what each of these five parts of the mind, so-called mind, do and how they operate and how we use them in terms of, how the divinity uses them in order to experience the world that it created. So let's look at these five parts of the mind. The fifth part of the mind, the lowest part of the mind, is the part of the mind through which we evaluate things based on their external qualities and characteristics. For example, when I look out into nature, I see something called a tree, and I begin to evaluate and come up with description and definition of that reality called tree based on how it appears to my senses. How does it appear to my touch? How does it appear to my taste, if I want to taste the bark or the leaf or the fruit or whatever? How does it appear to my sight? Is it tall? Is it thin? Is it broad? Is it green? Is it brown? You know, how do I hear it? How do I hear it when the wind blows? What kinds of sounds do I experience? So how do my senses interact with this thing called a tree? And we do this with everything, all physical reality. We evaluate it based on our sense perception. That's the fifth division of the spirit. And so we say the fifth division of the spirit looks at things from a segregative or a congregative mode of functioning. It groups things based on how it appears to the senses, and it separates things based on how they appear to the senses. And it records these groupings as a memory. So, if I say to you, give me an example of a green leafy vegetable, you're going to go into your memory and call up the images of every green leafy vegetable that you are aware of.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see spinach, you'll see lettuce, you'll see kale, you'll
mm-hmm.
see dandelion, etc. Because all of these are classified as green leafy vegetables. And so you will organize them or separate things based on how they appear to the senses. You will separate green leafy vegetables from tubers. You will
right.
separate them from fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll separate them from melons. So all these things are either grouped or separated based on their external qualities or characteristics.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
That's the fifth part of the mind, or the lowest part of the mind. The fourth part of the mind is where now reality is evaluated, but it's not based on the externals of that reality, but it's based on the energy principles that operate through that reality. So, for example, keeping with our green leafy vegetable analogy, when I look at spinach, kale, collard, lettuce, etc., they all are similar in terms of their appearance. They're all green and leafy. So
right.
the fifth division of the spirit, the one we were talking about, will say, all of these things go together because they all look alike. So they're all will congregate them all in one pew or one church.
They're all green.
Right. They're all green. They're all leafy.
Mm-hmm.
They're all going to
mm-hmm.
have similar vitamin and mineral content. The vitamin A in them is going to be, you know, similar within range.
Okay.
The vitamin C that they have is going to be similar within range. But the fourth division of the spirit now is what we call the ebb part of the spirit. I don't know if I haven't been given the comedic names. So let me just do that so as we go up, we can use our own nomenclature. The seventh division of the spirit, the physical body, I answer is called the Kab.
The Kab. Is that K-H-A-B?
K-H-A-B. The sixth division of the spirit, our answer is called the Kaibit. The fifth division of the spirit, that's the first part of the lower part of the mind, what we've been discussing, is what our answer is called the Sahu. Now, the fourth division of spirit, which we're talking about now, is what our answer is called the Ebb. And the ebb is where we now evaluate reality, not based on its externals, but based on the principles that are implied or a part of the thing itself. So now we're looking at the functions of analysis and synthesis. We're on the fourth, fifth level. We had congregation and segregation. Now we're bumping it up a level where we're analyzing things and synthesizing things based on value, based on principle. So, for example, our green leafy vegetables, though they all appear to be the same, and they all may have similar physical content, in terms of their energy principle, they're different. What our ancestors understand is that, you know, there's a reason why lettuce is called, or it's referred to as cool, like iceberg lettuce, right? Because lettuce has a cool and damp effect on the body. When we eat lettuce, though it's green and leafy and it may have vitamin A and the same as spinach, lettuce is going to have a cooling effect on the body.
That's
Whereas spinach, when we eat spinach, will have a warming effect on the body.
That's true.
So they're both green and leafy, and if spinach doesn't get it for you, just try mustard green.
Right.
when you bite into a mustard green, you naturally feel the heat.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an energy. The energy of mustard green is warming, whereas the energy of lettuce is cooling. So though they both may be green and leafy, our sahu will say they belong together because they're green and leafy. Our ebb, which is now looking at things on a higher level, the energy that operates through things, will say we're going to separate them because the spinach has one effect and the iceberg lettuce has another effect. So we're analyzing and synthesizing things based on their energy. So whereas collards and mustard greens may look alike and they would be put together in one basket, and peaches and oranges may look alike and be put together in another basket we call fruit, on the sahu level, on the ebb level, we're going to put the orange with the spinach or the mustard, because they both have a warm vibration to them, and we're going to put the peach with the collard or the iceberg lettuce because they both have a cooling effect on the body. So that's the difference between these two divisions of the spirit. One of them evaluates things based on externals, how they appear to the senses. The other evaluates things based on the energy that is operating within that thing itself. Now, the third division of the spirit. Now, let me stop right there. In terms of the different aspects of creation, plant, mineral, animal, and human, the lower three, the plant, the animal, and the mineral, all on various levels, have access to the lowest three parts of the spirit. All of them have a physical component. All of them have this animating principle. And all of them have access to the sahu part of the mind. the lower part of the mind. Because they have memory. You know, the reason why you can train an animal, a dog, is because of its memory faculty.
Okay.
Right, so they all have access to the lower part, three parts of the spirit, as do humans. But now a separation begins to take place because this second level, this fourth level of the spirit, this ebb part of the spirit, the ability to analyze and synthesize and evaluate things based on principle as opposed to external appearances is an area where only the human now has access. So this is what begins to separate the human from the other parts of creation.
Okay.
Now, the third division of the spirit, which would be the third part of the mind going up, as well as the third part of the mind coming down, is the part of the mind where the what we call the omnipotent part of the spirit operates. And these top three that I'm going to talk about now, 1, 2, and 3, or 3, 2, and 1, however you want to look at them, those are the parts of the spirit that we call the divine parts of the spirit. So where the fifth and the sixth and the seventh were parts of the spirit where the animal and the mineral and the plant and the human operated, and the fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh are parts of the spirit where the human operated. Parts 1, 2, and 3 are where the divine operates.
Okay.
So now we have a separation in terms of functionality or access. So the third part of the spirit is that the divine part of the spirit, which houses the omnipotent aspect of God, the ability of God to bring into manifestation anything. That's where that resides.
Okay.
The second part of the spirit is where the omniscient aspect of God resides. That's the part of the spirit which is all-knowing, which knows all things, through which wisdom and truth are discernible. And then the top part of the spirit is the part of the spirit wherein the omnipresent aspect of God dwells. That part of the spirit which through which we experience or which is experienced the oneness with all things. Now, the question is, how does God in the manifested realm experience the divine parts of his being? Now, we've already eliminated the mineral kingdom, the plant kingdom, and the animal kingdom as vehicles for potential expression of divinity, because they all got cut off at the fourth. None of them have access to the fourth division of the spirit.
Okay.
The division of the spirit right next to or right below the divine parts of the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only humans that can operate on the fourth division of the spirit, which is the part of the spirit which is right below the divine parts of the spirit.
Okay.
And so it's only humans then that can access the divine part of our spirit, of God's spirit, which gives us the true meaning and purpose of what the vehicle, the form of vehicle that we call human. You know, human is a bad term because human just means, you know, human comes from the word humus, which means earthly man.
You know what's so interesting, by the way, everybody, my special guest today is Paramount King of the Aseraset Society, Brother Orwa Hehi Metura Nkamed. We're talking about comedic spirituality today. This is interesting. I mean, I am really loving this, and I'm sure that you are too. And you know, brother, for a lot of people, you know, when it comes to their concept of God and connecting with God, you know, you talk about prayer. It's like, listen, I just want to pray. You know, I just want to say a prayer, my prayer to God. God hears me and God answers me. I thought there was one spirit. I didn't know there was all these different divisions to the spirit. You know, so for a lot of people, this could be complicated, but as complicated as it may appear to be, it takes study. I mean, we've been taught, you know, those of us, many of us who are listening today, were brought up, you know, and many are still in the Christian society or the Christian form of worship, and we've been told to study the Bible. Now, in this system, in the Osirian system, it really is going to take intense and immense study of your spirit. I mean, to really understand the different divisions of the spirit and what these divisions, what goes on in these different divisions, what are the characteristics of these different divisions. Brother, what about somebody who says, you know, listen, you know, my purpose, I came, you know, I was born to sing. You know, I was born to be a blessing to other people through my voice. I've got a gift, a talent to sing, and that's why God put me here, to sing. You know, others might say, hey, I was born to play basketball. You know what I mean? I was born to do this, or I was born to do that. But from what I understand about the Osirian religion, we were born to be vehicles of God's expression in the earth, to be God, men and women in the earth. Now, that may or may not, you may not be able to sing, you know, or even though you might be singing, you might be utilizing that voice and making money doing it, but still be off in terms of expressing your divinity. Is that correct?
Okay, yeah, let me see if I can wrap this into the context that you're putting it. From the African perspective, from our ancestors' perspective, we all have the same destiny. We all came to earth to become God men or God women. When we talked earlier, we began talking about these scriptures that were recorded in the pyramid text. And in these texts, it talks about how God created the world, and through this creation, it came about the process of realizing its divinity through the things that it created. So, each of us comes into the world with the same purpose. We all come in to be a divine being.
Okay.
But each of us is going to be challenged to awaken our divinity through different avenues. We all come in the world with different talents awakened within us. And by the same token, if we have some things that are, some talents that are open, we also have some things which are latent within us. So these 11 laws that we spoke about, which operate through these seven divisions of the spirit, are the 11 faculties or 11 talents that are innate within each of us that each of us must cultivate. So, yes, I may have the talent to sing, but singing is going to be the vehicle through which I am challenged to awaken the divinity, which is my true self. Someone else may have the talent for athletics. So athletics, they're not here to become a great athlete. They're here to become a divine being, which is going to be awakened through their experiences through athletics.
Uh-huh.
So all of us come to earth to become God, to awaken our divinity. And through the understand the 11 laws that we are able to develop that divinity. We said a while ago that man, human, this human vehicle, this creature we call man, has an access to the divine parts of being, the only aspect of creation that has aspect to divine parts of being. So it's through that access, it's through our awakening our divinity, through our experiences on earth, through the avenues, the people that we meet, the circumstances that we come across. These are the things that shape the path of our destiny. Our destiny is already laid out. We're all destined to become God. And this, our ancestors were clear about this because, as I said, when they talked about the creative process, the supreme being, one of the terms that was used in the scripture was Osiris. So when the supreme being was creating the world, it referred to itself as Osiris. And then, in a part of the creative process, it created this vehicle called Osir, which what became a part of creation. So Osir is the vehicle through which Osiris is able to experience its divinity in the created world. So each of us, our true identity is one and self-same with the supreme being. It's said in the Bible, man was made in the likeness of God. So let's think about that for a minute. What does it mean to be like God? What does it mean to be made in the image of God?
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine God being angry? Can you imagine God being lustful? Can you imagine God experiencing any of these emotions that grieve him? What would happen if God woke up one day and was just so grieving so that the sun never came up? How would the world look if God got really angry and decided that I'm just going to burn everything up? These are human emotions. These are emotions that are experienced as a result of our animal part of the spirit. We have our animal, we experience the animal through our brain. We have different parts of the brain. We have the animal brain, through which the what's called the reptilian brain and the mammalian brain are the parts of the brain through which our emotions are experienced. The four F's, our urge to fight, to flee, to feed, and to reproduce. All of these urges, which are part of the animal part of creation, function within us through the animal part of our brain. So those are legacies from our animal past. As we evolve, animals don't change into people. We have access to different aspects of creation through the evolutionary path. So
sometimes
we
act like animals. People say we act like animals. If you say animals don't turn into people, some people say that people act like animals.
Exactly. That's only because we're identifying. That's the self-image that we accept. We have these different self-images, and how you see yourself is going to determine how you respond.
Mm-hmm.
If you see yourself as an animal, then you're going to respond in animalistic ways. If you see yourself as a human, you're going to respond in human ways, which means what? You're going to see yourself as a being that is going to have access and failures, successes and failures. And you're going to justify your failures because what? You're only human.
Mm.
So as long as we identify with the animal part of our being or the human part of our being, we will always be experiencing life through successes and failures, through these emotional roller coasters that are part of the energy spectrum of life itself. But then we have another self-image that we can identify with. That's divine self-image. That's that image that was referred to in Genesis when it said man was made in the image of God. That's what was meant by the likeness of God. This divine self-image is the image which says that, yes, I may experience these urges, these animal urges, these emotional urges, but those are not controlling factors of my being. Those are just experiences of the lower aspect of my being. The higher part of my being, the divine part of my being, has the ability to give the proper response to the situation. So let's say I have a boss which is constantly giving me, quote-unquote, the blues.
Mm.
And so every time I go to work, I'm going through this emotional tirade. I'm feeling depressed, or I'm feeling angry, or I'm grieving, or I'm feeling sad, or I'm feeling whatever you pick your poison, whatever the emotional response is, every time I think about or see this man that I call my boss, if that's how I'm responding and I'm functioning out of the lower parts of my brain, which operates and controls the lower parts of my spirit. But see, we have also a higher part of our brain, which is called the frontal lobe. And this is the part of our brain which is to give us the ability to resolve things from above the emotional responses that the animal parts of our brain gives us the option to. It's
okay.
The frontal part of our brain, the frontal lobe, which gives us the ability to see and evaluate things on a higher level. It's the part of our brain which gives us the ability to see and evaluate things from the divine perspective. And from the divine perspective, we understand that peace is our natural response to any circumstance that we come in contact with. Peace is the only natural response that we have in life. And why
wow.
is that so? Because peace, we said the world is based on law, right? Remember, we talked earlier about the Kamaic scripture that said, God created
mm-hmm.
himself first as the creator, and then before it created anything, it created the law. And then standing on the law brought everything else into existence. So everything
right.
is based on law. But what does law mean? Law means that I can count on the same response every time something happens. For example, there's a law which says two objects of equal density cannot occupy the same space at the same time.
Okay.
Which means that if I run into a brick wall, I'm going to bounce back. Why? Because our bodies, we have the same density, and we can't occupy that same space. The wall has the space. It's more dense, and so it's going to occupy the space.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding that law, when I see something that has a greater density than me, I'm going to move around it as I try to run through it.
Right.
There's another law which says for every action is an equal and opposite reaction. Now, a good example of that is when I take a step, the weight of my body is an action upon the earth. And the earth pushes back with the same amount of pressure, same amount of power, same amount of weight that I exerted on the earth. So that when I walk on earth, then I have a smooth course to follow. Now, what would happen if when I stepped on the earth, rather than pushing back with the exact same amount of energy, weight, that I put on the earth gave me back four times the amount of energy. That means that I would end up flying and hitting the ceiling.
Exactly.
Because giving me back, if I'm 150 pounds, and if I take a step, the earth gives me back 150 pounds of response, it keeps me on the same plane.
Mm-hmm.
But if the earth gave me back 400 pounds of response, that's going to push me up against gravity into the sky. I'm going to find myself bouncing off the ceiling.
Or conversely,
so
if it gave you one pound of resistance to your 150 pressure, you would fall through the floor.
So what would happen? We would if we couldn't rely on the exact same response every time we took a step, we'd be afraid to move. Right? We would be getting angry and frustrated and grieving and sad, experiencing all these emotions because there's no law, nothing we can count on. So it's law that gives us the peace, which is the highest law, which says peace is my essential nature. So peace is my natural response to any and all things, because God created a world of law, which gives me then the peace to understand that if if I live according to these laws, I can guarantee, I know what the result is going to be.
Brother,
so
Orwell,
law
wanted,
gives us peace.
I wanted to ask you this, brother. Excuse me for, pardon me for interrupting, but it appears that, because we're winding it down, but I don't know. Do you have more time? Because I just want to, you know if we can stretch it out a bit further. I know we've been going for about an hour, but, you know, this is good. You know what I mean? And I'd love to continue it because I know this is a topic that is it's in depth and it just can't be covered in, you know, in 1 hour. We can lay the foundation, but I don't know. Do you have more time? Because it's about 5 minutes to eight now, Eastern Standard Time. Do you have more time you can go?
Sure. I can go.
Oh, okay. All right. Go ahead, my brother. I'm listening.
So let me wrap this up then. So peace is our essential nature. That's the first law, which says that peace then is the only natural response to circumstances in life. So that if I understand that peace is my natural response, any other response is causing harm to my being. When I get upset, when I get angry or frustrated or grieved or whatever, science has shown that it affects the functioning of the frontal lobe of the brain. It reduces our mental capacity. It reduces our IQ. It reduces the ability of us to make the best choice in any given situation. So if I allow emotions, anger, frustration, grief, whatever the circumstance is, whatever the emotion is, to decide, to be the determining expression in response to any circumstance in life, then I am denying the divine part of my being the ability to be experienced.
So I can hear somebody saying now, okay, I just bought a brand new Mercedes-Benz, parked it outside the house. Young guy comes by, jumps in the car, steals it, leads the police on a high-speed chase, and crashes my brand new Mercedes-Benz into a wall. I'm supposed to be peaceful?
Exactly, because
okay,
if you're not peaceful, you're only hurting yourself. Okay, mm-hmm. You lost the car, which isn't hurting you. But if you get angry, and you got all this adrenaline that's flooding your system, which is a toxin, which is a poison,
okay,
if you're diminishing your mental capacity, you're lowering your IQ, then you're going to function in a way which is not in your self-interest, your divine self-interest, which means that not only will you have lost, quote-unquote, a possession, now you have the potential to lose your access to your divinity or to put yourself in harm's way where you could have a greater hurt. You might lose your life responding in the wrong way.
I got one for
you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, a good example is martial arts. If anyone has ever studied martial arts, a good martial arts teacher will tell a student that if you're in battle, as long as you don't allow your emotions to take control, you have the ability to be victorious. But as soon as you allow anger or any other emotion to enter into your thing, you've lost the war. And as it says in the Art of War, as soon as you defeat your opponent mentally, he's defeated. So it doesn't mean that I'm not going to fight someone. It means that I can't allow the emotions to control my battle. I have to be at peace in the midst of the confrontation, which will give me the ability to do the right, to make the right move, to be victorious in this, whatever the challenge is I'm experiencing in life.
So if I understand you correctly, and I believe it, but I'm just for the sake of discussion here, peace is my natural response to every situation that I encounter. So any emotion other than peace is unnatural to my person. I should not, I have the ability to remain peaceful in every situation. So if my purpose for being born is to be a God, man, or woman, a vehicle of God's expression in the earth realm, then any and all situations that come upon me or that I experience, I don't want to say happen to me, but any situations that I experience are opportunities now for me to tap into that power that in fact is going to help me to realize my divinity or my purpose, which is to be God in earth, correct?
Exactly.
Okay. So then let's say if you take a woman whose husband goes out and cheats, you know, he catches some, you know, disease, comes back unbeknownst to him, gives it to her. Okay, now, that's going to try her peace. Okay,
exactly.
As much as she may want to be godlike, you know, and not only does she have to deal with the fact that, you know, he was unfaithful, now her life is on the line because of him, you know, that can be a very challenging thing, but of course, according to the Assyrian perspective, that is an opportunity for her to realize her divinity on the earth. Now, I guess my question would be, because that's a heavy one, that would be a heavy one for anybody to handle, male or female. Does that, when people experience things on that level, is it because they may have mastered all of the other, you know, the other tests or whatever, that it would take something like that, something so extreme for them to go to God or become God? You know what I'm saying? Because that's a heavy one. I mean, some people would say, gosh, you could have gave me something lighter than that.
Well, not necessarily. But there's an old saying that God never gives us anything that we can't handle.
Okay.
And what the essence of that saying, what is really being said there is that every situation that we experience is there to give us the opportunity to tap into our divinity. The more challenging the situation, the greater the reward, right? The more you work at something, the more you have to work at something, the more resistance, the greater the strength. So, which is to say that, look at it from the other perspective. If that person does not call upon peace as their primary response, then what they're doing is they're undermining their ability to be successful through that challenge.
Okay.
Because these other responses, anger, grief, are all going to undercut their vitality.
Okay.
These are all
that's
unnatural,
true.
Which means they're not good. Anything that's not natural is not beneficial to us. Peace is healing, right? They say that the major challenge to all in all illnesses is quote unquote stress, a major contributor. Well, stress is just another way of what we're saying is a challenge to peace.
Okay.
So if I'm able to relax in the midst of whatever the situation is, meaning to not allow stress to be the determining factor or to be a factor in my response, then I'm setting myself up, giving myself a greater opportunity to heal.
Okay. Wow.
So,
yes,
this
is awesome.
She may be ill as a result of having a challenging situation because of the indiscretion of her mate. But to not respond peacefully to that situation is going to undermine her ability to overcome that illness.
My special guest today is Orowa Hehimetura Nkomet, Paramount King of the Osara Set Society in Washington, D.C. This is an awesome, awesome interview, brother. I am thoroughly enjoying it. My person is really soaking up all of this information. If we can, I mean, there's a couple of things else I want to touch upon. I want to touch upon the summer solstice. We just passed into that. I'd like to also talk about, if we can, the importance of names. You've written a book, you know, about African names, unlocking the keys to your destiny, and how that relates to our sojourn here on this planet, and, you know, the energy in names and the importance of being called by a name that reflects your divinity or reflects your your purpose or your I guess for lack of a better term, purpose here this time. Could you please talk about names and their importance?
Okay, let me try to make this as concise as possible. And to do that, I'm going to use the imagery and the scriptures from ancient Kemet. It said, when a person is born, there's three deities, for lack of a better word. These are divine potentials. The deities are are metaphors for our spirit, divine aspects of our spirit. So there's three divine aspects of the spirit that are present in the birth and process. One is called the spirit that works with midwives.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an energy. To be a good midwife is to tap into a spirit that will enable you to function. Everything in the world requires energy. Everything requires energy. And different things require different energy. So to be a midwife is a different kind of energy than is required to be a mechanic, for to speak, for example. So there's the deity of midwifery is there. There's also the deity of destiny, which says to us, again, what we said earlier, that we all come into the world with a destiny. And the third deity that's present, and these two, destiny and this one, are pictured silhouetted against one another. The third one is called Reninit. And this is the deity of the name. So what our ancestors are saying is at birth, we come into the world with a destiny, and we come into the world with a name, which is silhouetted or joined with our destiny. So look at it as two sides of the same coin. So our destiny and our name are linked together. Another way of saying it is our name is a vehicle through which is there as a tool to help us achieve our destiny.
Uh-huh.
So our ancestors, and we find this same practice throughout Africa, traditional Africa, is that there's an understanding that when people come into the world, that there's a name that is going to help them achieve what it is that they need to achieve in life. There's a name that's going to guide them through their experiences to help them move toward becoming the God man or the God woman that they need to become.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we become that God man or God woman through the talents that we have already cultivated and those which we need to cultivate through the earthly experiences. So if I'm a musician and I'm here and I have a talent of music, then it's through that talent, through the experience of that industry, that I'm going to be given the opportunities to awaken the divine aspects of my being. Whereas someone else, their challenges will come through a different area of life. We were all moving toward the same goal, to become divine men and women.
You know, that's so interesting, brother, because, you know, a lot of times people think that, you know, the whole purpose is to just basically be good, and when you die, you'll go to heaven. Not to become God, man, or God, woman in the earth, because we have been taught that, you know, like we talked about earlier, that, you know, to err is human, you know what I mean, to forgive divine, you know, that we're going to make mistakes, that we're going to slip and fall, and what can you expect? I mean, hey, you're human, you know? And so the whole thought of being like God, because we've been taught God is perfect and that we're not perfect. So even to aspire to be a God man or a God woman, for some people, it's so lofty a goal that it's like, well, why try to be God on earth? I'll never make it. You know, I can never be God on earth, you know. And, you know, so for a lot of people, that is something that's so far out there that the expectation to do that or to achieve that is not something that a lot of people can comprehend, but I can imagine, I can only imagine a world in which everybody knew that that was their purpose, to be God, man, God, woman, and actually strove towards that and actually used the different tools available to us, the names, the oracles, you know, the different things that God has placed in the earth, in the world, for us to use to become God, men, and women.
Now we got to get everybody else to accept that imagination.
Well, brother, listen, if we
think about it this way.
Yes.
To the person that you were talking about. Now, there are some people who just, their consciousness set has not elevated to the level where they're going to see that there's something more to life than what they can touch, feel, taste, and smell. Not everybody is going to see that at the same point in time. We all come into this understanding at different points in time through different experiences, and there's no blame there.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone and everyone, if we just look at the world in which we live, we can all see that there are a lot of big problems in this world. There's wars everywhere. People are afraid to go out and walk the streets at night. There's all this fear and tension and apprehension and anger and grief over loss, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the world in which we live. Everyone, no matter what their spiritual perspective is, level of spiritual understanding is, can see that world. So the question becomes, is that the kind of world that we want? Is that the kind of world that we are willing to accept? Are we just going to accept that that's the way it is, that's the way it's always been, and that's the way it's always going to be? And if we accept that that's the way it is and all has always been, then we're not a good understanding of history. Because our ancestors have experienced and laid an experience and showed an experience through their world that's not the way the life has to be. But by the same token, if I want a better world, if I don't have to be worried about someone stealing my brand new Mercedes-Benz, if I don't have to be worried about someone going out and cheating on me and then bringing me back an illness like you described earlier, if I don't have to worry about someone, I'm walking down the street and someone just attacking me for no apparent reason.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't have to want to worry about those things, then I have to begin to see the world on a different level and aspire to function on a different level and begin to teach everyone and show everyone that we've been sold a wrong bill of goods. Those who would have us believe that we're only human and so therefore we're always going to be limited in what we can accomplish, etc., are those who really, in fact, want to control us.
Mm-hmm.
Because they control us through our emotions. They control us through pandering to our fear. They control us through our pandering to grief. They control us to pandering to lust. All of these, and telling us that these are the best that we can hope for, are just vehicles of keeping us under control. Because once we understand that we're divine by nature, and that peace is our natural response to any situation, then that moves us beyond the ability of anyone to manipulate us through our emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And if all of us begin to live, we may fall short a time or another. Every time I see my boss, I may not be able to call up the peace. But that doesn't mean that I can't call up the peace. It just means that, you know, as I fall down, you know, to be successful in life, you have to be willing to dust yourself off and get up and try again. We tell our children this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We tell our children, you can accomplish anything. Don't give up. So you may be struggling with mathematics, but all you have to do is work hard, and you can overcome this. We tell every child the same message. But then, on the other side of the mouth, on the other side of the mouth, we tell you you're only human, which means you're going to be a failure. And so we grew up with these conflicting messages because the messages conform into a worldview that gives other people control over us. Our ancestors gave us a worldview which says you are a divine being. And as such, you are the master of your life. And that every circumstance, every situation, no matter what it is, we come into the world with the talent, with the ability, with the power, with the wisdom to be able to be successful in that situation. Those are our divine rights. And as long as I see myself as divinity, I'm not going to sell myself short. You're not going to tell me then that I'm controlled by sin. Because in the same doctrine where they say, oh, you're a sinner by nature, in that same book, it says, know ye not that ye are gods? In the same book, Christ, in red, in the New Testament, says, the things that I can do, you can do greater things. So how is it then that you tell me that I am limited and I can't overcome sin? When it's written, our ancestors in ancient Africa, thousands of years before that book was written, said, you are a divine being, and any and everything is a part of your divine right. In that Bible, in the Bible, it says you're a divine being. You're made in the likeness of God. You're made in the image of God. Know that you are God. Know that which the Son of the quote unquote the Son of God, or he called himself the Son of Man. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting discussion. The Son of Man says, yeah, I'm doing all this stuff. I'm raising Lazarus from the dead. I'm feeding the multitude with 3 loaves of bread and a couple of fish. I'm doing all this wondrous stuff. And he's not saying bow down and believe that in me. He's saying know that you can do these same things as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mindset that is going to transform the world. When each and every one of us accepts the fact that I'm a divine being, peace is my nature.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I'm a divine being. This is my self-image. I can strive to be this perfect being because that is my divine destiny. That's my birthright. That's what's going to transform the world. That's what's going to give us all the peace to experience life and the joy of the peace that we experience it.
You know, the words that you're speaking, my brother, today are so powerful that my wife, a queer chef in the tear, she's over here. She's pointing at me. I'm pointing at her. You've touched on some things that, you know, just really rang home today, and some things that we both needed to hear, and I'm sure that a lot of people out there listening needed to hear. My special guest again is Oruwahehi Metura Nkamit, Paramount King of the Osereset Society in Washington, D.C. Brother, let's talk about, if we can, the solstice. Just briefly, if you want to get into that, if you have a few more minutes, they just said summer began yesterday. What is the meaning of that? I mean, you know, a lot of times for a lot of kids, that means, oh, no school. We can go swimming now, you know, but on a spiritual level, what is the purpose of the solstice? People have heard of the summer solstice and the winter equinox. What does all of that mean, and what are we to, how can it benefit us from knowing this information, and, you know, what can we use with this info?
Well, we talked a little bit a while ago about energy.
Yes.
Spirit is energy. Energy is spirit. Our ancestors referred to this thing that we call spirit and energy, they refer to as Ra. And Ra is the metaphor of the energy of life itself. The energy goes through its fluctuations. Energy has its ebbs and its flows. Everything rises and falls. And as energy changes, we need to adapt to the energy in order to get maximum benefit from the energy that's present, or a better way of saying it. Think of a good analogy is a river. A river flows in one direction. If I want to travel from point A to point B, and I want to get there with maximum and maximize my effect with less energy, then I'm going to move with the current. So if the energy is flowing south and I need to travel south, then I jump in this river, and then all I have to do is just learn to float, and I can get to my point without exerting any force. Mm-hmm. So I'm using a greater force in order to supplement the limited force that I have within my own little universe. Because our bodies are a little miniature universe, metaphorically speaking. So we want to tap into the greater power in order to augment the power that I have, which means my power will go much further. So the Earth generates energy, and the energy of the Earth, like all other energy, goes through its ups and downs. So by understanding the nature of the energy at any given point in time on the Earth, if I put myself in sync with the Earth's natural flow, then I'm going to get more use and growth and benefit from my energy source. As opposed to fighting against the current, I want to flow with the current.
Okay.
So the solstices and the equinoxes are points in the year when our spirit is most receptive to transformation, taking a transformative image and impregnating that image toward development. So, summer solstice, this period of at least 4 days, is a time when anything that I want to change in my life, because everything, again, works on energy. So any habit that I have works on energy. It runs on energy. It uses my energy. But let's just say this habit has a negative impact on me. Let's say it's like I get angry at certain things, or I smoke, or whatever the bad habit is. It's pulling on my energy. So if I want to get rid of this habit, then I need to attack it at a point where I can change the behavior. And so the solstices and the equinoxes give us opportunities where our spirit is receptive to transformation, to change.
Okay, now I heard you mention 4 days. So starting from yesterday, did I hear correctly that from yesterday, starting yesterday, 4 days, is that the window?
Yes, June the 21st to the 24th, December 21st to the 24th, are the summer and winter solstice. So on these 4 days, what we should be doing to the best of our ability is meditating on the changes that we want to make in our lives. The things we want to bring into our life, the positive things we want to bring into our life, the negative things we want to get rid of, to remove from our lives. Because these are the times when our spirit is most receptive to making these transformations, making these changes. Not that you're going to make the change on the 4 days. It's when you're planting the seeds for change.
Okay.
It's just like any other seed that you plant. You put an apple tree seed in the ground. Well, you just don't put the seed in the ground and water it a couple of days and then forget about it. You have to keep coming back and nurturing that seed. You have to keep coming back and nurturing the seed, and eventually that seed is going to sprout, meaning you're going to begin to see the beginnings of what the transformation that you want to take place. And eventually that seed, that tree is going to bear fruit. So now you're going to experience the fruit of your labors. So the solstice is when we plant the seed, but during the period of time that follows the solstice, we want to continue nurturing those seeds so that they begin to take root, so they begin to sprout, so they can eventually sprout and mature, so we can experience the fruit of the change that we want to have in our lives.
Wow. This, my brother, is... this is food, this is food. And I want to thank you, my brother, again for, you know, breaking all this information down. This is a foundation upon which we can build and learn and grow. And I'm sure that there are going to be a lot of people out there that really enjoy this information. I know I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I know you've been teaching. You know, you had a class before you actually did the show today, so I know you've been talking for a long time this afternoon, you know. So, again, brother, I want to say thank you so much for being my guest today on Jawanza for Life. Again, my guest today is Orawa Hehi Metura Nkamit. He is the Paramount King of the Osara Set Society. So for those of you who are wondering, who might be hearing this information for the first time, like Osara Set Society, what is the Osara Set Society, brother? We got like 5 minutes left. Can you kind of give the people who might not be familiar with the society, what is the Osara Set Society?
Okay, the Osara Set Society is, and we're celebrating our 40th year this year. As a matter of fact, there's a big gala celebration taking place in New York, August the 3rd. It was founded 40 years ago by the Shechem of Shechem, Ra Nephraim I, who's the author of the Meduna Tere series and a host of other books. But the Meduna Tere series is a series which takes this information we've been talking about and presents it in a studyable manner. And the other part of that, of this lesson, of these teachings, is that just as we talked earlier about people who have talents for different things. Well, if you have a musical talent, if you're you want to make it good in the industry, big in the industry, then you're going to find someone, a coach, to help you develop and cultivate that talent. If you have an athletic talent, then you're going to find a good coach to help you develop and cultivate that talent. We're talking about awakening the talent that will enable us to become divine men and women, God men and women, which requires as much as any other talent that you need to cultivate, the need for guidance and coaching. So within our system, we have an initiation program which anyone can access and participate in, which gives us the steps, the step-by-step process through which we're able to awaken our divinity, develop this divinity, to cultivate this divinity, and to guide us toward becoming the God men and God women that we are truly destined to be. So what I would suggest, if people go to Taui, that's TAUI.biz, go to that website, then they'll find information about the books, they'll find information about the initiation program that anyone can tap into, which will help us move toward, give us the guidance, the coaching that is necessary to become the God men and God women that is our true divinity, our true destiny. The same we have coaches become a good doctor or a mechanic or whatever. The same as above, so below. To become a God man or a God woman, we also need spiritual guidance and coaching.
Brother Orawa Hehi Metu. Let me say that right. Brother Orawa Hehi Metura Nkamit. He's the Paramount King of the Osara Set Society. Brother, we've got less than a minute to go. I want to thank you again so much for being my guest today. I just want to say hello to everybody in the Osara Set Society and the DC Gnome. This is Jawanza. I remember you. I miss you all. Brother Orawa, again, I want to thank you so much, brother. I'm going to be in contact with you to see if we can have you back as soon as possible, my brother, because I don't want this, I want us to get a proper goodbye. I don't want this to cut us off. So, again, I want to, 50 seconds, my brother. I just want to say thank you again.
Okay, and thank you. And people go to Google Meduna Tere, and you can get information from the Shechem of Shechem, the King of the Society, and our 40th anniversary. So we'd like to see everyone there take a part of that. Thank you.
Thank you, my brother. I'll be in touch. And hopefully, maybe we can have you come back on as soon as possible. All right. Take care now.
Okay. Hete.
That was Brother Orawa Hehi Metura Nkamit, Paramount King of the Osara Set Society. I thoroughly enjoyed the show today, and I hope that you all will continue to go back, listen to the archives. My name is Jawanza. Thank you so much for your time. Peace and blessings. Everybody have a wonderful week. Peace.